Has global warming finally gotten your attention? Well, it's not just about pleasantly balmy winters. Other impacts include disruption of our food supply, hunger, warm climate pest infestations, rising sea waters, resulting in displacement of millions, and much more. You don't need to wait for the government to act to change the dangerous course that the vast majority of scientists say we're on. Healthy Planet is a non-profit organization that teaches that many of the world's most daunting health and environmental problems have their solution in the choices we make every day. One of the most important actions you can take to reduce global warming gases is to eat lower on the food chain. That's right, less meat equals less pollution. In fact, a new UN report states that livestock production is a greater source of global warming gases than transportation, as well as being a leading cause of water pollution and a loss of biodiversity in the world. And reducing your meat consumption can pay you back personally, with reduced risks of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer, to name a few. For more on this, and to attend Healthy Planet's popular educational and social events, call them at 631-421-5591 or visit them on the web at www.healthy-planet.org. A healthy planet is ours to create.
WUSB, Stony Brook. Welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program as part of Natural Alternatives. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you at every point in your life right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world, the one that the vast majority of us really do truly deeply want. Today, we're going to be discussing a rather exciting topic with Robin Kennel. She is a registered dietitian here on Long Island, and that topic is diabetes. Diabetes is exciting? Well, yes. It's an exciting topic, not because it will give you a momentary thrill like watching the trailer of a movie, the new Game of Thrones trailer. A lot of people watch that, or the Avengers movies. It's exciting in a whole different way, because the information we're going to be sharing today can make a massive difference in the quality of your life and all the lives of your family members now and for the whole rest of your lives. It's really invaluable what you can take away from this next hour. Now, for those of you who do not currently have diabetes, you might be thinking, well, this doesn't concern me. Well, consider this. The number of adults with diabetes in the world increased from 108 million in 1980 to 422 million in 2014. So the unfortunate truth is that diabetes is likely coming to a theater near you. Bringing it closer to home, consider this. I've interviewed a number of people on diabetes over the years, and in the late 2000s, I interviewed Dr. Neil Barnard. He wrote a book on the topic. And in 2010, I interviewed Dr. Michael Greger, where we also spoke about diabetes. And at that time, the figures showed that over 20 million Americans had diabetes. As of 2015, that number had risen by about one-third, to 30.3 million Americans. 9.4% of the U.S. population has diabetes. So this is a condition that is increasing rapidly. In addition to that 30 million, 84 plus million have prediabetes, a condition that, if not treated, often leads to type 2 diabetes within 5 years. So more than 100 million adults are now living with diabetes or prediabetes, according to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That's almost one-third of the population of this country. One-third of the population. And then bringing that even closer to home, in 2014, 391 people on Long Island died from complications related to diabetes, with over 13,000 people being hospitalized with diabetes as the primary diagnosis. And we'll discuss some of what those hospitalizations are for. It's not pleasant. It's a source of a great deal of pain and suffering, resulting in, just for example, over 70,000 amputations each year due to the complications from this disease. Additionally, it costs our medical system an estimated $327 billion each year. The bottom line is that it's almost a certainty that you or someone you know is or will be living with diabetes or prediabetes. So this show is for you. But here's what makes the topic exciting. It's not that people are getting sick and dying, but that while diabetes was the seventh leading cause of death in the U.S. in 2015, it's one of those diseases that is most often preventable and even mostly reversible. Now, for any of you who have this disease, that is just about as exciting as you can get. Because anything in our lives that happens that's of an exciting nature, like a movie or a TV show or an experience, comes and it goes. It starts and it ends in relatively short order. However, if you can get some empowering information on this disease, you know what a difference it would make to start walking back that disease and to start regaining your health. And on that note, I'm going to bring in our expert guest, who is going to be sharing a lot of information on how to make this transformation to a diabetes healing diet. Her name is Robin Kennel, and she is a registered dietitian and a trained chef with an Associate of Science degree in Culinary Arts and a Bachelor of Science in Culinary Nutrition. She completed her dietetic internship at Stony Brook University in Stony Brook, New York. Sounds familiar, huh? Stony Brook, that's where we are. She's an active member of the plant-based community, an ultra-marathoner, and a health educator. Through her work as a dietitian at ShopRite, she serves Selden and the surrounding community by offering free one-on-one nutrition counseling, healthy eating classes, cooking demonstrations, supermarket tours, and health presentations at nearby schools for local kids and teenagers. As a plant-based dietitian, Robin uses education and encouragement to fight disease and states that while prevention is always key, reversal is often possible and emphasizes that living with a disease doesn't have to mean dying from it. Thanks for joining us on The Healthy Planet, Robin.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
It's a real pleasure to have you here today. We're going to start off with the basics, and that is, what is diabetes? And also describe the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes.
Great question. I get that a lot, actually. So type 1 usually happens more in younger children or adolescents. It can also happen in young adulthood as well. But that is when the pancreas stops making insulin. And when it does that, blood sugars go rampant, and there's nothing they can do unless they just take insulin. So they have to get it from an outside source. So they are insulin dependent. Type 2 is really different. I often think that they should be labeled as completely different diseases because with type 2, it is reversible. Type 2, they do have a working pancreas. They might have a low-functioning pancreas at different parts of the disease, but it is still functioning. And the issue with type 2 diabetes is that we have insulin resistance. We have insulin, but the insulin is not working.
And you say they should be called something entirely different. They used to be called childhood onset and adult onset.
Yeah.
And that changed.
That completely changed because now we're seeing type 2 diabetes in young children as well.
Right. So, again, most people have heard about this disease, but very few people have a real idea, unless you have it and you've been told by your doctor, what damage this can do to your body. So why don't you talk about that?
So when you do have high blood sugar levels with type 1 or type 2, we'll talk about type 2 a little bit more today because that's the one that we can actually prevent through dietary changes and lifestyle. But with type 2 diabetes, the sugar in the blood is not getting into the cells where it's needed. We actually, all of us, run off of glucose or some type of sugar to energize us. But instead, this sugar is staying in our bloodstream, unable to penetrate any of our cells. So then it runs rampant, gets higher and higher. And by doing so, it actually damages little blood vessels throughout our entire bodies, whether it be in our little toes, our fingertips, our eyes, even our kidneys. It just starts damaging the rest of the body because our body shouldn't have high blood sugar levels like that. And that's when people start having neuropathy in their limbs, and that's when they have no feeling and pieces of their body are actually dying. And that's when the amputations occur. Also with blindness, the number one cause of blindness in this nation is from type 2 diabetes. So when the nerves in the eyes get damaged by the high blood sugars, people go blind and people start to lose some of their vision. Actually, there are people that, you know, start seeing shadows, that can barely see. And actually, they can reverse that too with dietary changes if caught in time. But I think one of the scariest things is when you lose function to your kidneys. So when the sugar damages the vessels of the kidney, and the kidney shut down and you go into kidney failure, that person will be on dialysis. And I think that's one of the scary things that can happen from type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, so it all comes from the damaging of the blood vessels as a result of high blood sugar. There's not supposed to be that much sugar rolling around in the blood. We'll
Correct.
Get more to that. And I've also heard that it can cause depression and anger and changes in your intelligence, creativity, concentration, and more.
Absolutely. So the body regulates that blood sugar. And when it's at a high level, the body cannot function the way it's supposed to.
Hmm. So it has far-reaching effects, but it's all coming from the same mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certain that only a small portion of the public knows what actually goes on in the body that leads to this high blood sugar happening. So describe what causes this disease to manifest in the body, starting with what happens when one eats, let's say, a standard American meal, and going forward from that.
Sure, absolutely. So there was a big misconception out there that just eating carbohydrates causes type 2 diabetes. And you may have heard that before too, or like, don't drink too much soda because you're going to give yourself diabetes. And while that might be the case, but it's not really necessarily the sugar that would be causing the type 2 diabetes. It would be just the extra calories in general. So let's say someone's eating a standard American breakfast. Let's say it's some bacon and eggs and some white toast. When we ingest those high saturated fat foods, they start building up in our blood and start messing with our cells and start adding too much fat inside of the cells, which causes insulin resistance. Fat also goes to the liver, and we get something called a fatty liver. And when that happens, our liver no longer knows how to regulate the blood sugar and starts pouring more and more blood sugar out into the blood vessels. So now we're ingesting food that we can no longer put any of the sugar into the cells. Our liver is putting more and more sugar out. And now our pancreas becomes exhausted from constantly putting out insulin that's not getting utilized. So our pancreas actually starts to shut down a little bit. Some of those beta cells that create insulin die off. So all these mechanisms are happening at the same time. And now the sugar cannot get into the cell where it's needed because too much fat is building up. And at that point, that's when you have type 2 diabetes. It's not necessarily the carbohydrates that we're eating that's causing blood sugar raises. It's that we can't get any of the sugar into the cells. That's the problem. So when we're on these medications to lower blood sugar, again, we're just fixing that symptom. The symptom is the high blood sugar, but the cause is deep-rooted into our cells. All that fat building up from our high saturated fat American diet.
Hmm. And thus the connection between obesity and diabetes.
Absolutely. So usually someone is overweight or obese. Those are the main people that might have prediabetes or diabetes. Now, it could happen in somebody that's thin. That is more rare. But someone who eats a high saturated fat diet can also be prone to having prediabetes or diabetes. They just might have a really good metabolism and maybe they're not presented with being overweight or obese.
Now, as I mentioned before, a bit less than one-third of the U.S. population has diabetes or prediabetes. And I was going to ask you why it's so prevalent, but it's pretty clear that it's because most Americans have very unhealthy ways of eating and an otherwise unhealthy lifestyle, not enough exercise. We'll get into more of that soon. But describe the foods that are, in your opinion, the worst offenders in causing diabetes and why they're so damaging specifically to our bodies.
Absolutely. So the two categories of foods, I always say they're most they're the most dangerous, are processed carbohydrates and high saturated fat foods. And when they're in a combination, which a lot of meals in the United States have this combination, they're the most deadly. So something like a processed carbohydrate crust of a pizza with loaded with saturated fat cheese on top, that's a deadly combination right there. We have processed carbohydrates with cheese on top. Or like a hamburger, high saturated fat with cheese, high saturated fat on a white bun, now a high processed sugar food right there as well. Things like ice cream, tons of sugar in it, tons of saturated fat. Mm. So the biggest culprits are processed sugars with saturated fat. And saturated fat comes mostly from animal foods. So that's something that you should remember, unless you're eating tons of coconut oil or palm oil, which is a plant. But most saturated fat comes from animal foods. And the highest saturated fat foods are things like cheese, butter, red meat, fatty chicken, things like that.
Mm. Interesting. So it's the combination.
The combination is really bad. And when we don't have fiber, the problem is that these processed carbohydrates don't have any fiber. So they just raise the blood sugar rapidly. The fat comes in and clogs up all of our receptors so that we can't get any of the sugar into the cells. So now we have high sugar rush in the blood cells and we have all this fat clogging it up. It's just a really lethal combination.
Mm. Yeah, I get it. Now, you mentioned fiber. Talk about what fiber does in the bringing on of diabetes or the prevention thereof.
It is really good for prevention. So fiber actually helps to slowly digest our carbohydrates. So we get a nice steady stream of glucose going into our blood vessels and our veins so that our insulin can actually start utilizing it at a regular rate. When we start overloading our vessels with blood sugar, the pancreas has to work extra hard and produces tons of insulin to try to fix that. But if we can have a nice slow stream of it, it's easier for our pancreas to work. And then with fiber, we actually end up eating less because it digests slower. So we're not as hungry all the time. And if we don't overeat, we're not going to store too much fat and gain weight. And then again, that whole cycle just keeps repeating itself.
Hmm. So people hear this. They say, okay, I get it that it's the saturated fats from animal foods together with processed carbohydrates and sugars, that deadly combination. But what if I am obese now and I'm going to my doctor and I have to get a test? What test do I ask my doctor to do?
Absolutely. So usually people get tested once their glucose levels are pretty high. Usually something over 100 is something that would be a cause of concern. And then I would say they should ask their doctor to get a hemoglobin A1C. And that is a great tool because it tests your average blood sugar control for the past 3 months. A glucose test just tests you for that morning of, and it could be raised from the night before, whatever you had for dinner the night before. But an actual hemoglobin A1C will test your blood sugar control for 3 months. So even if you had one really bad meal, you know, right before your test, it's not going to go off of that. It's going to go off of how you've been doing for the past few months.
Okay. So if you're going to a regular doctor and they are not going to do prevention or reversal, what are they going to give you as a drug treatment?
So it depends on how bad it is, right? So usually they'll put you on metformin. That is the most popular one. That's the one that I see most prescribed to all of my clients. Metformin will help the liver to not produce too much sugar. So the liver is not going to put sugar into the blood. And it's also going to help with that insulin resistance. But I have seen people that have gone to the doctor and their blood sugar is so out of control, they get put on metformin and on insulin at the same exact time. So they just have really bad and poorly controlled diabetes, didn't know they had it, maybe didn't go to the doctor for years, and those people will go on multiple medications.
I saw Dr. Joel Fuhrman speaking recently, and for those who don't know, Dr. Fuhrman's the author of many books, including The End of Diabetes, and he's come out to Long Island to speak for Healthy Planet several times over the past few decades. And he's been a guest on this show. He stated that the treatments for diabetes themselves are not without risk. He used a stronger language, though. And he talks about how elevated insulin has been found to increase one's risk of certain cancers, as it's a growth-promoting hormone. It promotes the growth of fat cells and angiogenesis, the growth of new blood vessels, and cellular generation in general. It also causes weight gain, and the level of insulin in your blood is an indicator of your risk of heart attack, regardless of whether that insulin is produced by your pancreas or whether it's injected. So you don't want to take the insulin if you don't have to. And research by the American Institute for Cancer Research shows that adults with diabetes have about twice the risk of developing cancers of the liver, pancreas, and endometrium. There's also a clear but smaller increase in risk for colon and breast cancers. Finally, and additionally, 90% of individuals living with type 2 diabetes are overweight or obese. And obesity itself is related to an increased risk of cancer. So it all ties together. The factors that lead to and that are exacerbated with diabetes also increase our risk of other ailments. So ideally, we prevent the disease without putting ourselves into a position of needing to take these medications that themselves are going to cause not only a worsening of the condition of diabetes, but also problems with other diseases. And on that note, let's talk about prevention.
Yes.
What can people do to prevent this disease?
Okay, and I actually want to hit on what you were saying. So,
please.
With the medication, you're right. I mean, it does cause all kinds of complications. And the thing I don't think people realize, it doesn't cure the disease. It's not improving it. It's just fixing some of those symptoms. So the underlying cause of the disease is not reversed by just taking a pill. You're not fixed. It usually does get worse, and they usually have to get on more and more metformin or more medication. And that usually does lead to being on insulin, because like you said, you gain weight from these medications, and with extra weight becomes more insulin resistance. So it's really dangerous. So we should be talking about prevention. If anything, doctors should offer their patients the chance to change their diet before they're on any kinds of medication. That would be great. I am seeing somebody currently that I'm helping, and she didn't want to go on medication, and I have been working with her, and we're working on fixing some of those things. But as far as preventing, let's talk about that. So
yeah,
if we want to prevent, we want to keep our weight healthy. There's a thing called BMI. Bob, are you aware of the BMI?
Sure am.
We have height and weight. So I wouldn't say it's the tell-all, because for some people that could be borderline on that. Men and women have different body types and whatnot. But the BMI will tell you if you're a normal weight, overweight, or obese, or morbidly obese. And if you are, you know, in the overweight category, but you don't feel that you are, you can always do the waist and hip circumference test as well. As long as your hips are larger than your waist, you're usually in good shape. The more fat you have around your abdomen increases your risk of prediabetes and diabetes. So you don't want any of that fat along the abdomen. But preventing, it's really important to eat high fiber foods. And you know what foods are high in fiber? Plants. So we have our fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, and legumes. Those foods are all really, really high in fiber. So that will help to have a nice steady stream of blood sugar going into our bodies. As those foods are also really low in saturated fat. So our plant foods don't have a lot of saturated fat. Again, I mentioned before, coconut oil, palm oil, some of those foods that are exceptions. And then things like avocados and nuts have a lot of fat, but those are unsaturated. So those foods in general will help to prevent type 2 diabetes. And the last thing, I guess, is just being active, moving more, because we eat food for a reason. So when we're fueling our bodies and we don't actually use that fuel, if it's too many calories, we're going to start storing it as fat. And slowly over time, too much body fat can lead to prediabetes and type 2 diabetes.
So it comes down to, again, what we always come down to, no matter who we speak to. Of course, we're speaking to the people who know the most about this, the experts from all over the country over so many years, and it comes down to the whole foods plant-based diet. The same thing that's good for virtually every other disease. So if that diet you just mentioned is followed to the letter, what results can a person expect and in what period of time? And of course, it would depend upon the severity of their condition. But give us a general idea of various possibilities.
So are you saying if someone's type 2 diabetic currently?
Yes.
Okay. So it can actually, again, it depends on severity and depends how the body responds. But I've seen people in as little as 2 weeks see huge improvements in their blood sugar levels. The reason why I really enjoyed working with type 2 diabetes is because They have feedback every single morning when they check their blood sugar. So I can see if something's working right away. So usually when somebody eats whole foods plant-based for the first day or two, their blood sugars might go up because it's carbohydrate-rich foods, right? And right now they're insulin resistant, so they're unable to get those carbohydrates processed correctly. But without having all the additional fat, having that huge intake in fiber, slowly after those couple of days, all of a sudden the numbers start going down and they go down rapidly. So you can see changes in a couple of weeks. You can see full reversal in a month or two. It all depends on their level of commitment, of course, activity levels as well, if they're doing other things besides just eating healthy, and their bodies, and how long they've had the disease for and at which state. But I've had somebody last year, he was like one of my star patients. It took only a month. He was off of his insulin. He was off of his medication. But he was like really into it. The second I said, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, he took it to heart. And he decided to go for walks every single day because walking is a great exercise for anybody and it's really doable. So he chose walking and he saw tremendous results. In 3 months, down 50 pounds. I'm not going to say everybody can do that. He was a larger individual. So for him, it just started melting off and he just stuck to it. He kind of ate the same things every day. He really enjoyed it, but he saw big results. Now, on the opposite spectrum, I've worked with a woman that it was taking more like a year to get her numbers where they needed to be. So it just depends on the individual. She was also following everything to a T. And her A1C was going down every 3 months. It just wasn't as quickly as the other person I worked with.
So at the beginning of the show, I mentioned that this is an exciting show.
It's very exciting.
All right. This is exciting. I mean, come on. If you've got diabetes or you know someone who's suffering from diabetes and the side effects, 2 weeks to a year, it's nothing. That 2 weeks to a year is going to happen anyway. It could be 2 weeks to a year that brings you to a whole new place in your health and it cures you, or it could be 2 weeks to a year where you continue spiraling down. And again, the whole foods plant-based diet is the key.
Yeah, and who doesn't love carbohydrates, right? So when you're going on this diet, I guess you can call it, it's more of a lifestyle to me.
Exactly.
But when you're eating these foods, you can eat a lot of it. They actually showed a study that shows a plant-based diet, even if you don't lose any weight, if these people were forced to eat enough food so they didn't lose a pound on this study that they did, and even though they didn't lose any weight, their blood sugars all got better. Type 2 diabetes was reversed through a whole foods plant-based diet. So when I recommend this diet, I don't need people to feel restricted. I don't want them to eat tiny portions. I want them to eat a lot of plants. The main goal for me isn't just to have rapid weight loss, it's to improve their numbers and to improve the foods that they're putting into their body. So if you want a starvation diet, that's what the other diets are. But this diet is about abundance, about just switching your food choices, eating more nutrient-dense foods, more fiber-rich foods. You don't have to feel hungry all the time, and then see your numbers get better.
And one of the things I find fascinating about hearing about nutrition studies is that you can look at two credible studies and come away with two seemingly very opposing conclusions. Or you can have two people looking at the same study, like a newspaper or a news source drawing one conclusion, and another news source or experts coming to another entirely different conclusion. And I'll just mention something that happens when we were speaking recently before this show. I had mentioned to you that I heard a study that said that there was a 30% increase in diabetes from eating potatoes. And your response was something to the effect that there are potatoes and there are potatoes, since many of potatoes are French fries, and of course that's filled with oils and processed, and many potatoes are filled with sour cream and other toppings that themselves are the problem. And when I looked further into that study, I found that you hit the nail on the head, because the study actually showed, and I wasn't told this, that French fries were the worst offenders. It also showed that for those eating a whole foods diet, the risk of eating potatoes was neutral to negative, meaning that potato consumption was either helpful or unrelated to one's risk of diabetes. So I know you like potatoes, so talk a bit about potatoes in the scheme of diabetes.
I do love potatoes, and I'm so glad you brought that up. When you showed me that study, Bob, I was kind of hurt. I was like, no, potatoes are bad for us, but everything I've read is saying potatoes are good. And the reason why I think so many people think they're bad for us is because we don't eat a plain boiled potato. If we were eating a plain boiled potato, we would see that we're not going to gain any weight from it. It's not going to cause any insulin resistance or anything like that. The problem is, like you said, what we do to our potatoes. People deep fry them, or they put tons of oil on them and roast them in the oven, or they make mashed potatoes. And how do you make mashed potatoes? People usually put a bunch of cream or milk or butter in their mashed potatoes, and not just a little. They do a lot of it in there. And then what do you put on top? Fatty gravy. So
true.
Potatoes are great. Potatoes with the skin have tons of fiber. They're loaded with potassium, vitamin C. They might be a little higher on the glycemic index if we're going to get into that. But other than that, there's nothing wrong with eating potatoes in a nice, healthy, balanced, whole foods, plant-based diet. They're actually great energy as well. So if you're looking to energize and if you're looking to stay full, you can eat a potato and they keep you so full because it helps with that satiety.
Another thing I find interesting is that if you're eating a standard American diet and your body is damaged and you are overweight and you are unable to handle insulin, these same foods that are really good for us when we're in a healthy state can actually cause problems.
Agreed completely. So when somebody adapts this whole foods plant-based diet, let's say halfway, let's say they're saying, oh, Robin said it's okay if I eat plenty of potatoes and fruits and carbohydrates and all these foods, but then they're still eating those high saturated fat foods and still damaging the body, it's not going to respond the same way. We have to cut out those damaging foods and include these healthy foods. If we do half and half, we're still going to have an issue.
And that's why you hear from people doing the keto diet, paleo diets, whatever, or various diets, the high protein diets, saying, oh no, don't eat fruit. Don't eat that fruit. Don't eat those carbohydrates, even the unprocessed carbohydrates. Those will cause problems. And they're not lying, but they're working with a body that's not in the ideal shape that it could be in.
Yeah. And you know, it's so confusing why fruit gets such a bad rap. And unfortunately, many of my clients that I work with get advice from their doctors that tell them not to eat fruit and not to eat potatoes. They're the two main ones that I completely tell them, no, you can absolutely have these things. And I just explain to them, you know, how diabetes works and why carbohydrates are not the problem. It's an underlying problem that we need to fix. But so many studies show that the more fruit you eat, the less likely you will become diabetic. Fruit has fiber. Fruit is also low in calories. So people can try to overeat on fruit and potatoes all day, but it's really hard to do. You'll be too full by the time you try to hit 15 to 2,000 calories in a day. It's really difficult to do. Now, fruit juice, on the other hand, is different. So whole fruit in its whole form really is not a problem at all.
Yeah. And fruit prevents virtually every other disease, too. If you look at the people who eat the most fruit, you see it's cancer preventative, heart disease. It's just basically good for you. So,
yeah, I'm not sure why people would steer away from foods that have high antioxidant levels like fruit does. And yet people go for things like sugar-free ice cream or candies or snacks that are low carbs. But then fruit is deemed the enemy. And that's what scares me these days when we look at fruit and say, that's not healthy. But then we grab all these packaged foods and those are healthy all of a sudden. It's very confusing.
It is. It is. And I bring that up so that people, when they hear someone recommending not to eat fruit or complex carbohydrates, unprocessed carbs, to think it's not that someone's lying. It's that we're talking about the better way to go, how to operate within a realm where your body is really healthy and it's utilizing natural foods in a natural way, in a healthy way, versus when you put your body in a state where it just can't handle foods that are the best for you. So it's not that there's a contradiction there, someone's lying, it's just two different models. And I would suggest that this is the model that is more appropriate both for our bodies and for our planet, and for every other creature on this planet. But we'll get into that later. So, Robin, take some time to describe what a one-day sample diabetes prevention diet might look like. From breakfast to lunch, dinner, snacks. Give me some examples of meals so that people will come away with some idea of where to go with this.
All right. So for breakfast, I usually recommend something like a bowl of oatmeal with some berries in it, sliced up banana, usually a tablespoon of flax meal. Flax meal is just really good for us. Tons of omega-3s, fiber, protein in there as well.
You can grind that up with a little coffee grinder.
Absolutely.
Before you eat it. So
I throw it right in my blender. It works too.
Yeah.
They grind up really easily. Very fresh. Throw that right into your oatmeal.
And they're cheap.
They're really cheap. That's why I always recommend flax over chia or hemp seeds, because they're actually more affordable. And the benefits in there is incredible. So pick up a bag today.
Yeah.
So anyways, throw that in your oatmeal as well. A splash of almond milk, and there's a bowl of oatmeal right there. Or, you know, if you want something a little simpler, just a bowl of, I love bran flakes, just regular bran flakes. Throw in a sliced banana or a handful of blueberries with some almond milk as well. You can have some whole grain toast. Some of my favorites would be like Ezekiel bread, which is awesome. I love Dave's Killer bread as well. Make some toast. Throw either a little bit of avocado on there, or maybe a little bit of almond butter or peanut butter, and maybe a side of fruit. Or something like a tofu scramble. Scramble up some tofu, throw some peppers, onions, spinach in there, and then have that with a side of fruit. That would be a few sample breakfasts, but there's so many more that we can talk about. And then maybe a mid-morning snack, maybe sliced up apple with cinnamon on top. I love sliced apple with cinnamon. It feels like you're having apple pie for a snack, which is amazing. Lunchtime, maybe a bowl of black bean soup. What's great about that is you can make a big pot of black bean soup and actually portion it out for your lunches for the week. Very convenient, very inexpensive, very healthy. Beans have tons of antioxidants, tons of fiber, which we keep talking about. So bean soup would be a great lunch. And then maybe having that with a piece of fruit on the side, maybe a little brown rice with the soup, maybe a side salad, whatever you feel like that day.
And I'll give you the bachelor version of that, because I was a bachelor for many years. Empty a can of beans into a bowl and put some soy sauce on it.
Yeah. Or I guess if you wanted to make it more black bean soup, beans in a bowl with some salsa on top. That would be more of
a
black bean soup feel.
Yeah.
And you could just blend it up.
Yeah.
And then maybe in the afternoon, go with a cut up bag of fresh veggies. I like to do a mixture of carrots, peppers, celery, cucumbers, and then have a side of hummus with that. That's the perfect afternoon snack. Dinner time. Oh, there's so many options for dinner. I love Asian fusion type meals. So I like to do maybe like some whole wheat pasta with, cabbage in there, broccoli, soy sauce. I like to make actually like a peanut butter soy sauce for my pasta dishes that are more Asian inspired. That would be a dinner. Or I like to do taco night, like a Mexican night, and do more beans and brown rice, lettuce, tomato, guacamole, or even Italian food. I make a really good tofu lasagna that's unbelievable. You can make ricotta cheese out of tofu, nutritional yeast, and a little bit of hummus, some spices, and then just layer up some whole wheat pasta with vegetables and sauce, and it's incredible. And then if you're still hungry, you can always do something like I like to do chickpea cookies. I make cookies out of chickpeas, actually. They are fantastic. Or something like frozen bananas in the blender. And they call that banana nice cream. So frozen bananas in the blender makes for a really creamy, delicious dessert.
Yeah, I've been doing something recently, the whole meal salad.
Ah, yes.
Which is so good.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. And I think the thing that kind of tips it over from being just kind of good to really good is I've been putting in bits of orange, and it just makes it so delicious.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, so a salad that you put all kinds of things in it, like beans and rice and that kind of thing.
I put beans and walnuts, fruit. Sounds like ungodly combinations, but when you put them together, it works.
Yeah, and I try to teach people how to make salads that taste good, because if someone says a salad is boring, I agree with them most of the time, unless you learn how to make a salad that's not boring. So majority of my salad is not a bunch of lettuce. It's a bunch of different things, and I throw beets in there, beans, whole grains, anything that I have left over in the fridge, and then I like to squeeze some fresh lemon on top, or I like to do a little balsamic drizzle and a scoop of hummus, and when I put hummus in my salad, I can mix it all together, and everything's creamy.
Oh, that's good.
But we have to learn how to make a good salad. I think that would help people like salads again.
Absolutely. And that is not like the salad you get at the deli that has some kind of packaged dressing and it's just iceberg lettuce.
Agreed. Yeah, or they have these ones in the store now that are like a pre-made little container of a salad. It's tiny. It's calorie controlled. And people actually say to me, Robin, you know, I've been trying this for a few days and I don't know how you do this. This is really hard having salads for lunch. And I'm like, I don't do that. That would be a snack for me. So their salads are tiny when you get a pre-portioned amount because the cheese and the ham that's in there and the dressing make the calories so high. But you can have a bigger portion when you cut out the fat. When the fat's gone, the calories are low, and you can. I use my biggest mixing bowl in my house to make a salad. It should be loaded with vegetables. It's the fat that causes the high calories, not so much the vegetables.
Right. Understood. It's funny because the other night I was making one of these salads, and I reached down into my cabinet, and I had a choice of one very large bowl and one extremely large bowl. And I looked at the extremely large one. I said, I want that one, but I think I'll just use this one because it just looked too big. It was like some big bowl that you make for mass recipes.
It would be probably too big, but it's nice to have those so you don't make a mess when I'm trying to stir everything.
Exactly, yes. So, there are salads and there are salads, just like there are potatoes and there are potatoes.
Correct.
So, what are the challenges that you face in transitioning someone who has diabetes to a whole foods plant-based diet?
Honestly, a lot of the times it's their family that they cook for. So I see a lot of women mostly that make a different meal for themselves and for their husbands and for their kids. And I feel like they all need to get on board. What I always say to them is have a conversation with everyone. Let them know that this will save your life. This, the way that you're eating is going to help the diabetes and that there's going to be some changes around there. Because nobody wants to make three different meals for the family. Everyone has to, I guess, participate and help out. But sometimes they do find it challenging that way. So they end up eating plant-based meals maybe a few times a week and then eating whatever their family eats the other times in the week. That's one of the challenges. The other one sometimes is cheese.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean? I can't live without cheese. That's one of them. But funnily enough, cheese is actually second to coffee creamer and milk. Ah. People love their coffee with milk in it or half and half. And transitioning to like a coconut creamer or almond creamer just doesn't do it for them. So that's one of the biggest challenges, I think, for dairy consumption is their coffee in the morning. So getting adjusted.
Interesting.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting as well. Huh. But I mean, besides the family and that, it's actually, people always say to me, oh, there's more options than I thought there would be. Like when I ask somebody, so how many vegetarian meals would you say you eat per week? They always say zero. And so then I ask, oh, do you ever do like a night where you just do pasta and sauce? And they're like, oh yeah, sometimes. I said, okay, well, there's one. So we start naming things off. And I think it's so very intimidating to ask somebody if they eat a vegetarian meal. They think, oh, no way, you know, I can't do that. But then they realize, oh, a bean burrito. Oh, that's vegetarian. Okay. Oh, my bowl of oatmeal in the morning. That's vegetarian. You know, that's plant-based. So it's interesting when they start realizing it's not as crazy or far out there as they might think it is.
Yep, absolutely not. And it's something that we know we really need to move so much more in that direction. New York City is going to start to test meatless Mondays in schools.
I saw that.
And that's just a great thing. But obviously, it really should be meatless weeks and then meat Mondays for those kids who are still eating meat. Because if we're talking about public health, we're talking about environments, we're talking about climate change, we're talking about animals, we're talking about world hunger, there's only one way to go, and that's really, really severely reducing the amount of meat that we're eating. And that came out in a study recently that I'll talk about on the next show, that they said that basically to stabilize everything, we needed to eat 84% less meat in this country. But let's move off that just for a moment and go back to the fact that the norm is not normal. The norm is something that's unhealthful at this point. So it's good to see that we're making the move, though, and shows like this are part of the transition. You know, we need to talk about it a lot first, and then slowly and rapidly, as is the case, that's what we need now, move to the desired ends goal, which is eating a predominantly plant-based diet.
Bob, you're so right about the normal, and I think about that a lot, how it's so normal to have a piece of meat at every dinner, and I don't understand how that happened. Why is that the norm? Why is everyone so concerned about getting enough protein every single day? And how come people are not aware of the high protein that, you know, that's in beans or whole grains or vegetables? Why do we think we have to get a piece of animal protein on our plates every day to be normal? I still struggle with figuring that out.
It is a really interesting question. And another thing that I look at in this vein is that if you tell someone to drink soy milk, it's becoming much more common now, but 10, 20 years ago, I would tell people to drink soy milk instead of milk. And they would say, ew, soy milk. And then I would think to myself, gosh, would you go under a cow and suck the milk from a mother who was recently pregnant, of course? That would not be gross. And yet eating milk that came out of a crushed bean is gross. And so basically what it comes down to is it's what we've been taught.
Exactly.
It's the social norm. It's what's normal. That's more important, more weighty in our decisions than what is actually gross or not gross or normal or, you know, it's just very interesting how powerful the social norms are.
Yeah, even like eating off of a chicken bone, you know, tearing off dead flesh and how that's so normal now. I don't get it either. But then eating, I don't know, a salad with some beans on top of it. And that's just so ew, you know, beans. But then we're just tearing apart carcasses and we're eating hot dogs. We don't even know what's in a hot dog. And that's so normal. And I don't know. I agree with you on that one, Bob.
Yeah. And it's funny because people listening to this show, you know, we're not talking to a vegetarian or a vegan crowd. We're talking to people who are on their way home from work and eating, probably most of you, a standard American diet. So I'm not saying this to make you feel uncomfortable with what you're doing, but just look at the process. You know, for me, it's been a long time since I've eaten a standard American diet. And when I see a chicken leg or something like that, I think of my own leg and I think of my own arm because really it's pretty much the same. It's flesh on bone with all kinds of interesting things in there.
Veins, tendons.
That keep me alive. And, you know, it's at this point, it's very comfortable for me after examining what is actually the result of my conditioning and what's actually the result of my values. And going the way of choosing what I believe in with my values, it's very comfortable. And it's no longer feeling like I'm giving something up by not eating a standard American diet. So keep in mind that on the horizon, that's a possibility to not feel bad about giving up all the unhealthful ways that we were brought up to eat.
We have to find a new normal and create our new family traditions, I think.
Indeed we do. So we've talked about diet, a little bit about exercise. Do you have anything else to add about lifestyle factors that impact diabetes?
We did touch on low saturated fat, high fiber, exercise. We touched a little bit, but it's so important for people to get movement in every single day. And I'm not talking about hitting the gym or going for a run, just walking. Someone who is overweight or obese is carrying extra weight on them already. And walking can be a great exercise. You're carrying extra weight. You're walking around with all that weight on you. I think that's the perfect exercise for most people. You don't have to feel intimidated by lifting weights or doing any special classes. It's just getting more movement in. And they do say the best exercise is the one that you will do. So find something that you find can be done. If you enjoy gardening, if you enjoy going for a walk, if you enjoy Zumba, whatever you actually enjoy doing, just do it often. And the next risk factor, smoking. We all know that smoking is bad for us. I think we're all aware of that by now. Yeah, a lot of us don't understand how bad saturated fat is for us. But smoking, I think everyone is aware that is a risk factor for many things, type 2 diabetes and heart disease, cancer. So that should be cut out for sure. Getting more sleep, actually. So we don't talk about sleep enough, but sleep is so important. When you don't get a night's rest, you actually are hungrier the next day. You end up eating more. You don't make the best choices. They do actually link sleep deprivation with higher risk of disease and mortality.
So, and what's your recommended amount of sleep?
They say anywhere between 7 and 9 hours a night. So 8 is the standard. And again, people that are overweight, sometimes they have sleep apnea. That, you know, that's a higher risk as well with extra weight. So if people are not sleeping well, it's just the cycle just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. But yeah, eight hours is all you really need, and just get on get in a good routine so that you can go to sleep at the same time every night.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
And in terms of the exercise bit that you mentioned, I wouldn't have understood that mm-hmm. as well as I do right now. I just spent some time in China, and I didn't exercise. I went to one gym one day, but we were walking a lot. We were walking up a lot of steps and down a lot of steps on mountains and whatnot. I lost 7 pounds, and I'm not heavy to begin with, but I'm better at this weight. And it was all from walking. And it's great. And it was enjoyable. And it was, it felt like it was doing something really good for my body beyond pulling myself up on a bar and, you know, getting my upper body stronger. It felt very stabilizing.
And there's something to be said about being outside too, right?
Oh,
When you're outside, it's definitely more peaceful than just being in a gym. Being inside all day, being at work all day, being in a gym, you want to get outside and get some fresh air. I know it's been cold, but layer up. It gets warm when you start moving.
Yeah, it really does. And there are a lot of great trails on Long Island that will give you that incline if you want it.
Yep, I was just out east this morning, Pominock. Pominock Trails, there's a long trail system out east starting in Rocky Point.
Yep. Beautiful. Beautiful. And it's starting to smell good.
Mm-hmm.
And the fresh air and the sunshine, all things that increase our health, of course, not to excess. Well, you can't get excess fresh air, but but the sunshine is good for you, by the way.
Yes,
and,
it is.
And we want to get some sunshine every day. There's been a sun phobia, then a lot of caution put forth that we should keep out of the sun, especially in midday. And some of that advice goes too far. It's looking at a problem and drawing the wrong conclusions. We've done a show on that before, but it's good to get a bit of midday sun. Just not too much, you know,
mm-hmm.
15 minutes, half an hour.
We need that vitamin D.
Yep, which helps so many things. Now, we've been talking about sweeteners, and for the most part, we want to keep to natural sweeteners. Are there any added sweeteners that you would say are more healthful than other sweeteners?
That's a tricky topic. So I feel like people are the most comfortable with stevia these days, but I even don't recommend stevia. If they have to have something, I guess I would say that's the best of the worst. I like to use maple syrup when I sweeten things, but I use very minimal amounts of it. My goal for people is just to, I guess, adjust their taste buds so they don't require as much sweetening, but then to use something more natural like maple syrup. But there's also another trick you can do if you have a little extra time. You can make your own date syrup, so date paste or date syrup, and just, you know, blending up some dates with water, keeping that in the fridge, and then adding that into things. I add dates to a smoothie if it's a little too tart or plain. That'll really liven it up. But really, really just use minimal amounts of sugar, because just using a bunch of artificial sweeteners will just keep that craving alive. The more we have sweet things, the more we're going to want it. I think that's the advice I always give to somebody, is just stop relying on sweetness.
Good. We talked about high-protein diets just a little bit, and do you have anything to say about the comparison between a keto diet versus a whole food plant-based diet and their efficacy in dealing with treating diabetes and preventing?
Yeah, it's coming up a lot lately. Even the woman I told you about that I've really helped her improve her diabetes with the whole foods plant-based diet over a year, it got stalled around Christmas time, like with a lot of people. And she's feeling more desperate because she's struggling right now. And she asked me actually last week about a keto diet. Robin, do you think that would be easier for me to maintain? And because right now I hit a plateau and I'm struggling after the holidays. And the issue with keto, it's high fat, as you all know. It's high fat and really high in saturated fats. So if you have a bad heart or high cholesterol, you're just adding more stress into those arteries than you actually really need. And even though a keto diet has no carbohydrate or sugar in it, and your blood sugars probably will go down, it'll appear to go down, but it's only because you're not introducing any carbohydrates. You're actually not reversing the disease. You still have the underlying disease, but you don't have the blood sugar to prove it because you're not eating any carbohydrates. A disease is not reversed unless you can actually eat carbohydrates and process them normally. You can't call diabetes reversed when you just cut out carbohydrates. That's not reversal. That's just called elimination of a food group.
not ideal.
Yeah, so the underlying issue is still there. They just don't have the glucose test to prove it.
Right.
But the inflammation will be super high.
Right. Okay, that's good. And of course, also with a keto diet, you're eating a lot of foods that we know are not foods that we ought to be eating for so many other diseases. We've mentioned many other times on this program the Unified Dietary Guidelines. And that was put out by the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the National Institutes of Health. Basically, they said there's not a diet for diabetes and a diet for cancer and a diet for stroke and a diet for this disease and that disease. There's one diet that basically addresses all of them, and that is a diet which is less processed foods, more whole foods, plant-based foods. And, you know, it's just good for everything. So across the board.
And
so
if we're
going on one of these specialty diets where we're eating a lot of meat thinking it's going to create a result, it'll create a result, but at the expense of everything else.
And if we're going on, there's one thing that Dr. Greger always says, if you guys out there don't know who Dr. Greger is, he is amazing. Dr. Michael Greger says, if a whole foods plant-based diet can reverse the number one killer of Americans, which is heart disease, right now we know the only diet that can reverse heart disease is a whole foods plant-based diet. No other diet has been proven to do so. And if the only thing it can do is reverse the number one killer in America, why not do that as the default diet until something else comes up? We know now it can reverse the number one killer. We know that it can improve and reverse diabetes. Why not do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Michael Greger has been on this program, and he's been out to speak on Long Island for our nonprofit organization many times. So you guys know him. Some of you don't, but hopefully you have a chance to see him. He's on nutritionfacts.org, I believe it is.
Yep.
Nutritionfacts.org. And he has great information. You can look up all kinds of information about questions you have about conflicting dietary information you heard. And he'll basically tell you what the latest studies say on it. Really a valuable resource. Do mainstream doctors, dietitians, and health authorities understand just how avoidable and reversible diabetes is? And is it reflected in the advice that's commonly given? So if I go to my doctor, am I likely to get good advice in terms of what to change in my diet that's not only going to bring down my blood sugar, but make me more healthy?
Sadly, no. Considering most of my clients have got zero information from their doctor about what to do with their diet. A lot of them don't even know it's reversible. They may have heard it was reversible, but they're starting to think that it's a myth and maybe only some people can do it. But they're really not getting much information. And I'm not sure if doctors know what to say to them on how to change their diet, to be honest with you. So I think that they're getting conflicting information from their doctors and from anybody else just because the doctors don't really know what to say to them.
I guess that's a lingering problem. That just like we're all learning about what to do, we're all learning about what to eat, what not to eat, and our habits are formed when we were very young. Doctors' habits were formed when they were in medical school, and also from what they learned from their parents and what they learned from their ancestors. And so it's a slow process until there is some education. But I see it much more widespread now, that there is the possibility of a doctor at least acknowledging that certain things can change. I know that I went to a quote-unquote holistic doctor, and we were talking about preventing and reversing issues that were related to a stroke. And he said, there's nothing you can do to clear the arteries out. And I had to school this holistic doctor on Caldwell Esselstyn, and, you know, the various information that we have that's coming out of Robert Ostfeldt, who's spoken at our dinner a couple of years ago, and just the various whole foods plant-based doctors who reverse cardiovascular disease. And so it's slow in coming, but I do see it as coming.
Dean Ornish, one of the first ones.
Yeah, decades ago. And he actually had a whole program, and it was actually decades ago covered by insurance companies, which was what made it so amazing at the time, unlike anything else at the time.
Yeah, and there are some doctors, and I don't want to say all doctors are the same. I do get some of my clients saying, my doctor said she's giving me 3 months to make some changes. I just don't think they have the time in their days because they're seeing many patients to sit down with them and really give them a good dietary plan. So it's not really their fault. They don't have the time to really talk with their patients long enough. So I'm glad when they come to me and ask me for dietary help because that's my job.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And it is true. I'm not saying it is the doctor's fault because I know how busy they are.
Mm-hmm.
The life of a doctor is not an easy life, depending on where you're working. But if you're working at an institution, you're pushed from the beginning, from when you get into work to when you leave, patients after patients after patients. And then there's the notes and catching up with everything. It is a challenge. So it's a matter of getting this into society and then having patients ask the doctor for it. And when the doctors are asked enough, they'll tell the administration that, hey, we need to get into this more, and they'll open up some kind of complementary dietary associated wing in their hospital. That's in the future. But I do see some hospitals doing that, actually, taking a much more holistic approach.
Bellevue in New York City currently has a plant-based program.
Bellevue in New York City. And as we mentioned, Montefiore in the Bronx with Robert Ostfeldt.
It's growing. It's coming.
It is. It is. The time has come. So you're meeting with someone, let's say, who has diabetes or has a family member that has diabetes. What resources do you offer in terms of websites, articles, books? What do you tell them if they want to delve more into it and really get a handle on how to approach this disease in addition to the counseling that you'll give them?
Yeah, I try to get a feel for if they enjoy reading books, if they're more into videos, because there's so many different resources out there. But I definitely recommend Dr. Neil Barnard's book, Reversing Diabetes. That was the first book I read on the subject matter, and it was awesome. Very helpful. Recipes in the back, and it explains everything that I'll be explaining to them in our sessions. I also like to send them videos from nutritionfacts.org. Dr. Michael Greger makes some wonderful videos on diabetes and what studies prove that a whole foods plant-based diet can reverse the disease. Dr. Furman's book as well that you spoke about briefly, his book as well, or going online to Forks Over Knives, the website. Forks Over Knives has so much information and so many recipes that you can choose from when you're transitioning to a whole foods plant-based diet.
We're wrapping up, but I want to ask you about, just in general, what new research, and not related to diabetes necessarily, fascinates you? And what are you most interested in these days?
So what's really been interesting me is fasting and all the studies that they're doing with water fasting. They do a lot of it out in California. Have you heard any about this, Bob?
I have.
Yeah.
I've done a good deal of fasting over the course of decades, starting out with long-term fasting, juices and whatnot. And then one day a week, I was doing water fasting. And then more recently, I was doing the intermittent fasting. But I'll let you continue.
It's really intriguing. It was a couple years ago. I was at a PCRM conference, the Physicians Committee of Responsible Medicine. They have a conference every year in D.C. Highly recommend it. And they did a study on type 2 diabetics. What do you know? And they compared two different groups. They had one group that did 2 meals a day and one group that did 6 meals a day, which I used to always recommend. Yeah, have six small meals throughout the day. That's the best thing you could do for diabetes, blah, blah, blah. But they finally put it to the test. And what do you know? The same exact calories for 2 meals a day versus 6 meals a day led to higher fat loss, higher weight loss, and better blood sugar control just because they had those hours that they were fasting without constantly digesting food and putting sugar in their blood. They actually did better. So that got me intrigued by that. And then all the work they're doing at True North out in California, Dr. Alan Goldhammer is doing a lot with water fasting. He is taking people off medications for high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes. He's even helping people with cancer. It's difficult to grow cancer when you're not eating any food. So, and then Dr. Longo out in California is also doing a lot of research on fasting and how to live longer. It helps with aging. He's doing a lot of research on that. And I think I want to know more about it. It's definitely a harder one to do. I mean, you're not eating anything. It's tough to make money off a diet like that. You're not selling any products. You're just saying drink water all day. But look into it. It's really interesting. I used to think it was just a fad diet type thing until I saw actual respectable doctors talk about it and talk about the science behind it. And then now I'm pretty much on board. And it makes sense that we shouldn't be eating around the clock. Again, we got to have to find a new normal. It's normal to eat all the time. It's not normal to skip a meal, but it should be.
All right, Robin, we are out of time.
All righty.
Share your contact information if you have any, and also tell them about your availability at ShopRite.
Sure. People can call me at ShopRite if they want to make an appointment. I do free consultations out of ShopRite. I'm at Port Jefferson and in Selden. You can call me at 631-372-7057 or send me an email. It's Robin, R-O-B-Y-N dot Kennel, K-E-N-U-L at wakefern.com, W-A-K-E-F-E-R-N.com.
Fantastic. Robin Kennel, thank you very much for joining us on The Healthy Planet. It's been a great educational experience. And yes, it was an exciting show.
Very exciting.
My name is Bob DiBenedetto. I want to thank you for listening to the Healthy Planet radio program. I'll be with you again on Friday, April 12th at the same time. That's right, at 6 p.m. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives every week at this time. And you'll hear Beth Fitteni and Eugene Zamperone, various other people who are going to be giving you everything you need to hear at this time. Also, be sure to like our Facebook page by looking for Healthy Planet USA so you get notified of some of our upcoming shows and for all Healthy Planet event information. And the archive for this and all other shows will soon be posted at www.healthyplanetusa.org. This show should be up within the next week. www.healthyplanetusa.org. Until next time, stay strong, eat mindfully and with compassion. Meditate, relax, be kind to those around you, regardless of how many legs they have. Speak your voice whenever possible to protect our planet and enjoy this beautiful world that we all share. Good night.